right. This is CS50, the start of week 9. So we've got a great week of stuff in store for you. More on web, more on database, more on actually looking toward the final project. But first, the blink tag. So this is a tag in HTML that has been largely deprecated, which means the world hated it and ripped it out of more recent versions of HTML. But this week, will we teach you by way of a language called JavaScript to re-implement this incredibly annoying feature of websites 1990s style. But our other teaser for today is this. So thanks to our friends at Microsoft, they have a brilliantly named research and development center in Kendall Square called NERD, for New England Research and Development. It's a beautiful space, overlooks the Charles River. They've got a huge digital screen, and they're going to have a lot of pizza and candy waiting for us this Friday. So the first ever CS50 movie night will be this Friday. If you would like to RSVP for this and join us, friends and family and dates and such are welcome. Just go to cs50.net/movie. It's where everyone will be this Friday night. And what we will do is CS50 now operates its own shuttle services. So thanks to Shuttle Boy, Shuttle Services will be shuttling us over from Harvard Square to Kendall and back. The event itself is at 7:30, and the movie that will be on the screen is this year's course favorite. So for those unfamiliar, a little teaser trailer.
From Mike Judge, creator of Beavis and Butthead and co-creator of King of the Hill, comes a movie about people who go to work. Who are part of a team.
And remember, next Friday is Hawaiian Shirt Day.
Okay, but I could take the building untired.
Who respect their boss.
We need to talk about your flair.
Well, I have 15 pieces on.
15 is the minimum. Brian, for example, has 37 pieces of flair on today. And a terrific smile.
And need to escape.
I don't like my job, and I don't think I'm gonna go anymore.
One of these days, I just kick this piece of...
I'm thinking now it might be more fun to just get fired. And I've always wondered what that would take.
Oh, Peter, listen.
It looks like you've been missing quite a bit of work lately.
Well, I wouldn't say I've been missing it, Bob.
That's just a straight shooter with upper management written all over him.
We're going to be getting rid of these people here. Mr. Samir. Okay.
Night eating in a jar. Naeen in a jar.
Not going to work here anymore anyway.
You haven't been showing up and you get to keep your job.
Actually, I'm being promoted.
Thank you, Bob.
This is a... It sucks!
They're gonna throw you out on the street so that Bill Lumberg's stock will go up.
Ooh,
it's completely unfair. Inatech deserves to go down.
We're just the guys to do it.
Tell me about that virus you're always talking about. The one that could rip off the company for a bunch of money.
I'm not going to do anything illegal, Peter.
Illegal? Samir, this is America.
The worst they're gonna do is they put you in a white-collar minimum security resort for a couple of months. You know they have conjugal visits there?
I might be showing them my old face.
Oh.
They let you have sex with women?
They sure do.
Okay, I'll do it.
Office Space.
I know you've been getting pretty depressed about your job and everything, and so I just wanted to tell you, good things can happen in this world. I mean, look at me.
So coming this Friday to CS50, so if you think you can go, do RSVP via the website. Space will be limited, but we will follow up via email once we know the logistics. So also coming up are CS50 seminars. This is a tradition we've had for several years, where the teaching fellows and course assistants and Harvard affiliates offer some hands-on or conceptual seminars on material that's either just of technical interest to folks on campus, specifically CS50 students, or also on topics that might be of interest to you for final projects so that you can pick up some new skill or leverage some new understanding. This year's lineup includes such titles as these: BlackBerry application development, a crash course in Java, creating awesome websites with Ruby on Rails, which is another programming language and framework, developing apps for iPhone, iPod Touch, and iPad, educational software development, Linux demystified, if you're still a little mystified, making SMS mobile applications, modern client-side web programming, socializing your apps with the Facebook platform, Vim, and then we have dozens of past seminars seminars and videos thereof on this website here. So if you go to cs50.net/seminars, you can, one, see those videos, and two, RSVP for this year's lineup. Essentially, all of these seminars are in the process of being scheduled now. They'll be like an hour or two, sometime ideally between now and Thanksgiving, and the seminar leader will follow up with you once you've RSVP'd for it to figure out what might be an optimal day and time. And rest assured, if you can't make the seminar's daytime this year, it too will be videotaped and put online within a couple of days thereafter. So plenty of time to pick up some new skills for the final project. And just to plant this reminder, the final project's pre-proposal is due this coming Monday. This is a very casual but very much expected email to your teaching fellow just to let him or her know what you're thinking, to bounce ideas off of them, and to perhaps have a little sanity check as to whether what you're thinking is too easy, too hard, too much time, too little time. It's really just an opportunity to get the juices flowing, and then in a couple of weeks will the actual proposal be due. Also coming up from the IOP, if you would like, today in Mather House at 5 p.m., you can meet Alec Ross, who is the current Senior Innovation Advisor to Hillary Clinton, where he leads the State Department's efforts to find practical technology solutions for some of the globe's most vexing problems on healthcare, poverty, human rights, and ethnic conflict. So if you're interested in how technology and social networking tools can be used to aid diplomacy and social development, do check out this event in Mather House this afternoon. So my teaching fellows and CAs and some of your classmates had a little Halloween party yesterday, and I couldn't help but delight in the geekery of the jokes that get tossed around at such events like these. So at the risk of embarrassing one of them anonymously, we heard this line here during the preparation of the event, where some balloons were being hung and some Halloween decorations were being hung. This volunteer simply asked, "This here?" And his friend's answer, his or her friend's answer was, it's sad. We all laugh now because we all get it, for better or for worse. So that was a cute thing to see, certainly for a teacher. So I got this spam actually this morning. Some of you probably did too. Hopefully none of you actually clicked the link that you were given. This is from Harvard University. It was sent to me, a dear webmail user, and they explained that due to congestion in all Harvard University, webmail users accounts, Harvard University, would be shutting down some unused webmail account. In order to avoid the deactivation of your webmail account, you will have to confirm in a confirm that it is a present use account by clicking the secure link, all caps below. The personal information requested is for the safety of your account. Please leave all information requested. Then you can click here and go to what's clearly harvard.edu/secure/login, which makes it secure. And this is, of course, copyright the president and fellows of Harvard College. So the thing is, if you actually click through to that link, you actually end up on this here website. Too bad I clicked too late, because whoever had you signed up for this account has been deactivated. But we probably would have seen a little web-based form with text fields and a submit button, one of which probably would have said my username, one of which would have said my password. And you know, we kind of maybe smile now, or maybe you're a little worried that you did fill out a form at 123contactform.com. But it really is easy to do this. I mean, this is what's generally known as a phishing attack, where the adversary is essentially trying to bait you into doing something that sounds legitimate, technologically or socially, and it looks like this is a harvard.edu link. So surely it must actually lead there. But of course, as we've already realized a week ago in looking at HTML, all it takes to make a link in a web page is to say a href equals quote unquote http://, and then I could go to 123contactform.com and then some other stuff, but then I can close this tag. But recall that what goes inside this tag is the actual text that the user sees. So some websites would just say something like click here, some websites would say something like form, but some websites could very well just say http://harvard.edu/secure/login, and voila, you have this duality. The link says one thing but actually goes somewhere else. So if you're not sort of savvy when it comes to detecting these things now, in almost any email client, you can hover your mouse over a link like that and actually see where it actually leads. You can click it, but at least after you've graduated from this course, stop short of actually filling out the form and clicking submit. At that point, you've indeed gone too far. But it all boils down to the basics that we've started looking at today. So Where are we going with this? Well, problem set 7, which some of you have dived into, is on CS50 Finance. This is your first of two web-based programming challenges whereby you'll implement an E-Trade-like website whereby, thanks to Yahoo Finance, you'll be able to have users log in or register for accounts. They'll be handed some 10,000 virtual dollars, and then you can actually get nearly real-time stock quotes by typing in the stock symbol for a company. You can buy, quote-unquote, a stock from your $10,000 in cash by checking what the current price is and then buying those numbers of shares. And then the code you'll write for this problem set will actually keep track of all of these transactions, all of the buys, all of the sells, the sell point, the buy point, the prices at which you actually transacted these changes. And all of this will be logged in what's called a SQL database, which is what we'll now introduce as a mechanism for actually storing data around on disk or in memory so that the next time the user visits this page, they can actually interact with it seeing their own profile. So if I go actually to cs50.net/finance, you'll see the staff's implementation of this. And if you actually follow the link here that says play the big board, you'll actually log in as yourself, not as some fake testing account. And if you do that, and then follow up through to the big board for problem set 7, you'll see that all of us have lost at least 1% of our $10,000, those of us who opted into this here. So much like PSET 6 had its own big board, similarly will this one, just for fun, have its own big board. And now that I look at this, the mathematics are clearly off, because Michael Shen has up to $32,000, but he's only up 2%, and he's ranked last. So this is an example of a bug at the moment. In my defense, the markets were closed this weekend when I was testing, so I couldn't really get real data, but this is clearly my fault, so I will fix. But as it has it, David J. Malin is actually number one at the moment, so maybe I should leave it alone. So what's really cool about this is that this project originated really just as kind of a random idea where we wanted to do something related to finance. But to do this well, you really want to get some kind of real data, ideally, because if we just handed you a big Excel file and said, here are the prices of all these companies' stocks on October 1st, 2010, I mean, who cares, right? You could use that data. Much more interesting to interact with it in real time. So if I do a lookup for a company like Google, whose symbol is G-O-O-G, what you'll get on Yahoo Finance or really any of these websites that give you free stock information are details like the last trade price. Google currently goes for $614. When the last trade was transacted, what the bid and asking prices are. If you're not familiar with some of this jargon, it's not really a big deal for the PSET, but we link to a nice tutorial in the PDF this week that'll bring you up to speed on this. But what caught our eye is that there's all this interesting data on the page, and we could resort to a technique called screen scraping. Screen scraping or web scraping is just the buzzword that describes writing a program, usually in a language like PHP or in Ruby or in Python, something called a scripting language, which we'll revisit today and onward, that is whose purpose in life is to pretend to be a browser, make an HTTP request, and this is just a program you could run at the command line, on the cloud, on your own computer, wherever. It can be written in any of these new languages we're starting to play with. It makes an HTTP request to yahoo.com as though it's a browser. And that's not all that hard, because we sniffed my own traffic last week and saw that when you make an HTTP request, this just sends some of these HTTP headers, host colon and get and then dot, dot, dot. And so you can mimic that stuff very easily with a few print calls in a program. So we could pretend to be a browser, get this page, specifically this URL, because notice what's nice here is Yahoo apparently is using the get mechanism, which means you can parameterize requests of a web page by using a HTTP parameter. In this case, notice that the URL starts with finance.yahoo.com/q, probably for query, question mark. And the question mark means here comes some parameters. Here comes some inputs to this server. And the first input is called S. That's a parameter. And its value is apparently equal to G-O-O-G. So what this means is I could literally copy this, paste this URL into my own PHP program, and write code that says, go get that URL. And I can say, go get that URL every minute or every hour. I can use something, as an aside, called a cron job, which actually automates the process of running your code on a schedule. So with all these little building blocks, something like PHP, something like a so-called cron job, I could actually grab this data again and again. But unfortunately, even though it looks obvious to me, the human, that the number I probably want the most is this, the last trade time. Or you know what? Maybe it'd be interesting to get the current change. Maybe it'd be interesting to get the current opening price or the bid price. In other words, there might be a lot of pieces of data on this screen. And so those people in this world without a computer science background or any programming chops probably would open up Excel or Google Spreadsheet and then just start transcribing these numbers manually, right? Copy and paste. And that's about as efficient as you could get. But remember that underneath the hood here is some HTML. So if I actually go and view the source of this page, let's do it this way, view source, I'll see all this HTML. But my god, now finding those little needles in this mess of a haystack is really quite challenging. Even though the $600 is in there, this just looks like a mess. And this is what would come back if I wrote a program that requested a URL pretending it's a web page. Browsers, of course, know how to render this nice and prettily like this in a web page. But if I'm writing a command line program with PHP, now I have to parse or analyze all of this code. And this is where screen scraping, the process of writing a program that just crosses its fingers that that web page structurally is going to stay the same day after day so you can just grab data from it, is actually non-trivial. We, as a course, actually do this every night with Harvard Dining Services website to grab all of the meal data every day so that you guys, for your final projects, can use that kind of information. But long story short, it's not fun, generally, though sometimes you have to resort to it. But what caught our eye is at the bottom of this page, under this thing they call toolbox, is download data. And in fact, when I hover over this, I see that this is just a URL. It's going to look a little small here, but I can see that this download data link is just another URL, a GET request where S equals Goog, and then F equals a long string, and then CSV. CSV is comma separated values, and it's sort of a poor man's Excel file. It's a spreadsheet, but it just uses commas to separate columns. And so if you have a program like Microsoft Excel that knows to look for commas as delimiters between what conceptually should be commas, you can then open this file in something like Excel. So I'm going to go ahead and click download data. It indeed says I'm downloading a file called quotes.csv. So let me go ahead and save that. And then if I double click this file, because I have Excel on this particular computer, it's Excel that opens. And what's really neat is that I have the illusion of some columns here, Goog in the left column, then what appears to be its last trade price, what appears to be the date at which it was last traded today, the time at which it was last traded today. There are, of course, slight delays in a lot of these websites, which is why it's trailing by a few minutes. And then some other data that if I compare back and forth with the website, I could figure out which of these fields means what. But if I actually look at the text file that I just downloaded, this is just a file called quotes.csv. If I actually open this with something like TextEdit, this simple little text program, notice that's all that's in this file is that data there, separated by commas. And now as a programmer, this is really interesting to me, because now I don't have all this cruft of HTML and hyperlinks and colors and fonts, all this useless information. All I have now is the raw data. So this caught our eye. And so what you'll do in problem set 7, for instance, is write code that calls a function that we wrote that grabs this URL that has a stock symbol in it, whatever stock symbol you want to pass in as an argument to this function. We make the request to the web page, get back what essentially is an Excel file, a CSV file. We then split it on all these commas and then hand you back a struct, essentially, called a class in PHP that contains all of this interesting information. Now, not to dwell too much on Yahoo Finance, but moving ahead, whether it's for your research in the physical sciences or biological sciences or economics or really any field where you might actually want to analyze data or manipulate something or do something more efficiently than you, the human, could do via copy and paste, looking on the web or looking on computers for actually machine-readable data like this is where things get really interesting, because it means you can automate so much. And the simplest thing we automated last week, recall, was simply automating the idea of freshman intramurals. And what we were able to do last week is when the user submits a form saying, this is my name, this is my dorm, my gender, I'm going to be a captain or not, we were able to first completely throw that information away, which clearly was not all that useful. We just said, you're registered, but not really. But in the third version of last week's Frosh IAM's example, what did I finally do with that data? Yeah, so I sent myself an email. And back in the day, this would have been an email not to me, but to the proctor who was actually running the freshman intramural sports program. And if I take a look at that code, what you'll see here is that this was register3.php. Recall that at the very tail end of that last lecture, sending an email in a computer program reduced to just a few lines of code. I had a few variables, and recall that in PHP, a variable starts with a dollar sign just by convention. So I declared a variable called to and just put in my own email address. And notice the similarities with C, double quotes around strings. Although, as an aside, in PHP, you can often use single quotes as well. Semicolon at the end, so that's the same. Subject equals registration, body equals. And this one got a little interesting, because I didn't want to send like a short phrase. I wanted kind of a longer sentence. And so I wrote out body equals this person just registered, colon, \n\n, because I want to move the cursor down a couple lines in the email. And then notice this, the period. So the period, or the dot, is the concatenation operator in PHP. So whereas in C, it's really actually a pain to take one string and add more string to it and more string and more string. Because remember that a string in C is an array. An array usually has a fixed amount of memory. So you can't just blindly add more and more characters to the end of it. But in PHP, you can. Underneath the hood, the same kind of magic is still happening. The same kind of memory is getting allocated and deallocated as needed. But all of that is taken care of for you. And so notice what I concatenate onto that phrase is this, $_post, bracket, quote unquote, name. So what was this thing called $_post, generally speaking? What was the point of this thing? Awkward silence. Someone must know. Just conceptually, like what is this thing?
It's an array,
and you can infer that, frankly, from the square brackets. The notation is just like C. We don't have a number inside of those square brackets, but this is because we get a new and improved version in array called an associative array in PHP, whereby the indices, the things that you use to index into the array, no longer have to be numbers. They can actually be words or phrases, sentences, or more generally, things called keys. And so what I can now do is grab the value inside of this array at the location called name. Yeah?
What if you just try to use that same syntax but put in some key that doesn't exist?
Good question. What if you use the same syntax and I say, you know what I actually want to include in this email, even though I'm completely making this up? I want to say the value of the foo key, F-O-O. Well, what would come back is essentially the empty string, quote unquote. Nothing would actually happen. All right, so maybe that's OK if it wasn't actually a required field. But in this case, I know what these fields were called. Now, what's special about $_post is that, yes, it's an array. Yes, it's an associative array. But it's generally what PHP calls a super global. It's a special global variable that you just get handed for free anytime you write a PHP-based website that is automatically filled with any parameters that were submitted by some user via a form submission. So remember, we had the whole premise here was that we made a form, open bracket form in HTML. Recall that we specified method equals something or other. So let me actually pull that up. In froshims3.php, recall that we introduced this notion of a form last week. And this is fairly self-explanatory once you start, get the hang of the tags. Up at the top here, we have form. Action equals register3.php. So action just says, what is the action of this form? Where does it send its data to? Where does the data get submitted? And I decided that in addition to this file called froshims3.php, I'm going to write a file called register3.php. The purpose in life is to receive the form submission from this particular page. All right, the method I'm going to use is post. And we quickly mentioned this last week. There's two main methods. One is post, and one is get. And what's perhaps the most obvious difference between the two? Yeah, so using method equals quote unquote get means that the parameters show up in the URL. So in the case of Yahoo Finance, when I filled out that form in the top left corner and typed G-O-O-G and hit enter, recall that the URL changed, and you could actually see what I typed in the URL. And so that's because underneath the hood, Yahoo must be using the get method. Now, why is that a good thing, perhaps? Why use get? Yeah. Yeah, so you can bookmark it, right? If you want to add a bookmark to your browser, if you want to copy and paste it into an email, what's nice about the get method is that the state of the world as you currently see it, is embedded inside of the URL, so the state is retained. Someone else can follow that link and see exactly the same thing as you. Now, this is probably not the best method if you're trying to log into some account. You fill out a form with your username and password, or maybe your credit card number and your 3 or 4 digit secret code on the back of it, and then hit submit. Well, it's probably not a huge deal if you're sitting at home or in your dorm and the form is getting submitted from your own laptop to some server. But if you're on a public machine or if other roommates are in the habit of using your computer, any time the URL changes that's in your browser, what's a side effect of using GET? What's that? Yeah, so the password's going to show up as plain text in the URL, or more specifically, your history is going to remember that you visited that URL. So if you've ever gotten a little nosy and crossed that, let's call it an ethical line, and poked around at what URLs your friends or roommates have actually been visiting, it's got to be a few of you here, right? So that's the so-called history of a browser, and that pretty much records pretty much every GET request that was made with the browser. It's just logged in that dropdown. And of course, you can go to like tools and options and clear that kind of cache. But GET is not very good for privacy's sake. POST is generally better for that. And POST is also called for anytime you want to have the user upload something like a JPEG to Facebook. You can't really fit an image conceptually or even technically in a URL. You could change it to zeros and ones or some kind of encoding, but it doesn't really fit very well in a URL. So POST is also used when you want to submit large amounts of information. But the relevance to the FroshIMS example is that inside this form, there's an input called name. There's an input called captain. There's an input called gender. And each of these happens to be of slightly different types. I know this by just having read the manual or having learned how HTML works. And so I know that an input, its type can be text if you want a text field. It can be checkbox if you want a checkbox. Radio if you want a radio button. And there's a few others. But pretty much it's as straightforward as just saying what type of data you want. But because the action of this form was register3.php, what happens when I actually click submit is that this page, register3.php, which lives at a URL, if I go to this in a browser, I can absolutely visit this. I can go to froshims3.php, which recall looked like this. I can also go directly to register3.php, but notice that, let me disable this for a moment. I'm going to do one quick thing here. Print. Yes, here, exit. Just to prove that this file called register3.php can in fact be visited directly, I click here. And indeed, this is now just a web page on the internet. It's not actually returning legit HTML yet, but the URL is in fact web accessible. So I'm not actually submitting any parameters to this form right now, but if I get rid of this and actually access register 3 by going to froshims3 and saying I am David, I'll be a captain in Matthew's register, now it claims you are registered really. Notice I'm again at register3.php. So that begs the question, what happened this time? Well, if we look at this code, notice at the very top of the file, register3.php, notice the very first character, open bracket, question mark. This says, here comes some PHP code. Then the rest of this stuff for a little while is just comments. So uninteresting for our purposes now. But down here, we actually see some logic. And then we see close question mark, close bracket, which means end of PHP mode. So what is this PHP code doing? Well, it is this code that sort of magically, thanks to its being accessed via the web, has access to a super global associative array inside of which are all those key value pairs from the form that I myself created. So if I had made a much longer form with 10 fields, this associative array would have 10 different keys inside of it handed to me with the user's input. So I first do a sanity check. If the name key in this array is not equal to quote unquote, and the gender key's value is not equal to quote unquote, and the dorm key's value is not equal to quote unquote, what's the implication, sort of just in layman's terms? They filled out the form, right? They must, because those values are not the empty string, because they're not blank, obviously the user typed something in, and so they're not blank. And so now I want to do something with that. I'm going to assume, without doing much error checking in this version, that you know what, this person just registered. So I'm going to compose this email to the proctor, or to myself in this case. I read the manual to figure out that if I want to send it from myself, I can just say from :mailin@cs50.net, and then this stupid convention here, /r/n, you might recall that, but that was just from the documentation. But the real magic is just in this one line. It turns out that there is a function built into PHP, definitely doesn't exist in C, that is called mail. It takes four arguments, in this case, the to argument, the subject, the body, and then those things called headers, the additional metadata at the top. And the end result, recall, was that I was able to send an email to myself. And if I actually go check my mail now here, in this Gmail interface, this is what the proctor would see. But here's the sort of tidbit that's worth mentioning, perhaps for security and privacy's sake. If I actually view the details of this, indeed, it looks like I've sent an email from myself to myself. But it looks like with this programming power, I can say, you know what? I don't want these emails coming from me. I want them coming from Jansu, Idada, at fas.harvard.edu. Save that. Jansu's not here today. So now I'm going to go back to my inbox. I'm going to go back to the form. I'm going to re-register as, let's say, Yuki this time. Also for Matthews, register. Says I'm registered. Let's go to CS50 mail. Reload the page. Oh, Jansu emailed me. And indeed, I have an email now from Idada at fas.harvard.edu. So don't even get us started on the insecurity of email, frankly. There's absolutely no fundamental authentication built into the email accounts that you and I use every day. Very often, if you have a sponsored account with a university or a company, the system administrators could very well prevent you from changing that address to something else. But even I use Gmail all the time. Yet if you've ever gotten an email from me personally, it still says harvard.edu because I'm essentially spoofing the from address. Now, sometimes when you do this, you increase the risk of your email getting flagged as spam because servers are getting increasingly sophisticated and they realize, wait a minute, this is from harvard.edu, but it clearly came from Google's servers on the West Coast. This can't be. This feels like it's probably spam. So it's not a perfect system, but fundamentally now, emails are very easily forged. And that's why I was able to get that email about the 123, what was it, 123, contactform.com, it's just as easy for spammers to forge any one of our addresses. So as a rule of thumb, if you ever do get an email that perhaps seems to be forged, frankly, what you can do in various email clients, including Google, if you look at the original, you'll see some interesting things. And we won't spend time on this here, but every line in the original part of an email shows you the IP address or the name of the server that this email passed through. So you can often do a bit of forensics and infer from these headers where this email actually came from. And if we do dwelled on this example, we would see that came from Idada at FAS and yet entirely through Google servers. So how could that be? Or actually not even Harvard's Google servers. In this case, it came from our own cloud server, which is not FAS. It's, of course, CS50's own domain. So I would be remiss if I didn't say don't actually do this. And I'll say this from personal example. Freshman year, I was really proud of myself when I learned this trick and how you can just put any email address you want in your email client and voila, send an email. So I made the unfortunate social and perhaps political decision to send an email from someone else in my proctor group, but like a complete moron, forgot that I send out emails at the time with an automatic signature, which happened to say DJM. So this email I sent to my whole proctor group on some stupid kind of issue made some point on behalf of a roommate whose opinion I was trying to change, whatever the stupid story was at the time, and it was like, sincerely, Joe, or whoever the person was, DJM. Caught. That was not a good time. So again, do as I say, not as I actually do. Kind of recurring theme here, perhaps. But really the takeaway for today is that the cool power here is our ability now to automate very mundane, very tedious tasks and also to have these processes scale. Frankly, one of the neatest things about being able to make a website that's not static, but that's dynamic using a language like PHP, and we'll see today using a database like MySQL, is that you write this kind of code and then you walk away. You go to dinner, you go about your business, and the thing runs itself. Frosh IAMS continues to get registrations. Some of you have probably RSVP'd for the movie already, and that's because we set up a form that's doing that automatically. So you really get this ability to automate processes and free up your own human cycles to solve much more interesting problems. We do this all the time, certainly this semester with 500 some students. Anytime you submit those damn forms, we get 500 new submissions to deal with, but we automate the process of dispatching all of your individual responses to your teaching fellow. We synchronize with the server to do so, and really humans have to be relatively uninvolved in that process. So you can start to do some neat things that benefit you, the person. All right, so what more can we do? Well, let's take a look at FroshIAMS 4.php and inch our way toward actually using a database, because frankly, at some point, the proctor's expectations are going to rise. And he or she is not going to be cool with getting an email every time one of 1,600 freshmen registers for a sport. They'd much rather this information end up in a spreadsheet or end up in a database so that he or she can look at it anytime they want, but not have to manually copy and paste from these emails. So in 1996 or whatever, sending an email, this was improvement because it meant no more paper. But we can do much better, and we can do much better relatively easily. easily. So first take notice of this. This is froshims4.php, and you may encounter this paradigm in section or an example code that you see in books or online. Realize that the action of a form does not need to point to a separate file. You'll see in problem set 7 that we do this consistently. We have one file, say login.php, submit to login2.php, because I think in terms of the mental model, it's nice and simple. There's step 1, and then there's step 2. But realize, once you now have the ability to write this code yourself, you can actually have, as in this case, a file called froshims4.php submit back to itself. Now, why in the world would you want a web page, like a form, to submit not to a different URL, but to the same exact URL, to the same file, in fact? What might be the value in that? Some murmurs, yeah? Update the what? So update the web page of the user data, possibly. Let me point out one of the sort of downsides of this current approach. If I go back to register 3, suppose that I actually don't fill out this form and just click register. I can't demo it with this example. What happens on the most annoying of sites? You click submit, you then get to a page, and it says, sorry, you need to provide your email address. And then you have to hit the back button, and sometimes on these horribly designed websites, the whole form is then blank, and you have to start all over again. So if you're actually sending the user from point A to point B, the problem is that point B is probably going to look different, and yet if they made a mistake, you want them to go fill out point A again, and so why not just leave them there if possible? So one of the tricks we can see here in this next example is if I look at froshims5.php, if I want to detect that an error has happened, I can do this at the top of the same file and then leverage this information. So let's see what this thing does. First, I'm going to go to froshims5.php. Let me suppress this error message with a little trick for now. Ignore that little detail. I'll fix it later. Oh, another trick. Ignore what I just did there. Fix that later. Whoop. Okay. Damn it. All right. Close your eyes for another moment. Line 37. The server I'm using is slightly different from the server you'll be using. That's my excuse. All right, I'm losing credibility today. Okay, perfect form, right? So now this is froshims5. Now suppose I just say, all right, you don't need to know this information. I'm just David. Register. Oh, damn it. Line 15. Here. This is fast. This is one line of configuration on the server that will make that problem go away. Okay, so notice here, I said David, I clicked register, and then I got yelled at in red text, but I'm on the same form. So it looks as though that red text, you must fill out the form, is maybe being conditionally shown. And sure enough, if we just have some logic in the same PHP file, we can check, was there an error? If so, let me yell at the user. Otherwise, let me just show the form as usual. So this is froshims5, and notice that froshims5.php, first of all, this is almost copy and paste from everything we've seen thus far, so I'll gloss over some details. Notice that froshims5.php submits back to itself. And that's what initially is going to enable this neat trick of having this immediate feedback loop on the same page. But at the top of this file, notice what I did. Ignore all of these at signs. Though for those perhaps more familiar, the at sign is essentially suppressing these things called notices that we were seeing. But again, we'll disable those permanently for you. So notice this. If the value of the action parameter is true, go ahead and do this. Well, what's going on here? Well, notice here, I'm going to wave my hands at some of the details for now, but notice that if the value of name equals equals blank, or the value of gender equals equals blank, or the value of dorm equals equals blank, this time I'm actually going to set a variable called $error and just set it equal to true. One of the minor weaknesses in PHP is that it's case insensitive sometimes, but not always. So you will see some textbooks and resources say uppercase true. Sometimes you'll see lowercase true. Sometimes you'll see capital T true. It's kind of a mess. I would just, as always with style, be consistent. So I'll go with uppercase this time around. And so now error is true. So notice what's going to happen here. If I scroll down, notice this line of code. Recall that you can have if conditions in PHP code, and recall that you can commingle PHP code and HTML. So notice I have HTML, 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 HTML. Oh, open bracket question mark. Here comes some PHP code. I'm going to ask a question. If error is true, so again, ignore the at sign for now, but if $error is true, colon, do the following. So it's OK in PHP to then exit PHP mode, because so long as you've just answered true to that question, only the following lines are going to print. So div style, so this is where I get that red from. Div, again, is a division of the page. Style is for CSS. Color colon red makes the text red. And notice there, there's that sentence. You must fill out the form, exclamation point. And at the end of that is going to be my close div tag, which looks like that. And then end if. So in short, I just have a condition in my PHP code. It checks the value of error, which I myself set at the top of this file for the purposes of reminding myself later when I actually render the web page, was in fact there an error in this case. But we're still not doing anything with this information. So let's actually take one more step toward that and also move away from hard coding everything into our page. As soon as you find yourself in PSET 7 or 8 or any final project copying and pasting a lot, it's probably time to start automating the process somehow. So it turns out in PHP, you can declare an array, just as you can in C, and you can statically initialize it, which means you can put values in it right from the get-go. And they don't have to have numbers associated with them yet. They'll be inferred. And here's how we do this. I know from just having, you know, looked up some list of all the dorms on campus or figured them out off the top of my head that here are all the dorms. Feels like this is a good candidate for an array. Otherwise, I'm going to have to copy and paste the same HTML for each of these dorms so I can have that drop down again and again and again. So let me go ahead and declare a variable called dorms. I wrote it in all caps this time, just like you might in C, to say this is some global variable. This is a constant, rather. This is a constant storing all the values that aren't going to change. In PHP, there's actually a function called array whose purpose in life is to take zero or more arguments, and those arguments become the elements inside that array. So whereas in C, you would have just done a curly brace, unfortunately, PHP made the slightly annoying decision to call it array as a function, and so you have parentheses, and then white space, as in C, doesn't really matter, and I decided rather than having this be a huge long line of text with commas and quotes, I decided to put every dorm on its own line with commas separating them just to keep things kind of pretty. But that's just an arbitrary stylistic convention. But now notice what I do down here. You can generate forms even dynamically. So now notice what I've done here. The TD tags are part of the table. So TD is table data. So ignore, for today's purposes, some of the markup like TR, which is table row, TD, which is table data. Because like we saw last week, that just lets us structure something behind the scenes. And if it's new to you, it actually is pretty quick to pick up on. But the point for now is this. There's this other element. For some reason, it's not called an input. It's called a select. This is what the code with which you make a drop-down menu in HTML. But notice I can commingle some PHP here, too. I'm going to say select. Name equals dorm. So this is declaring a drop-down menu called dorm whose size is 1, which means you're only going to see one dorm at a time, which is generally the default. Notice that I wanted this menu to be blank initially, so I declared an option whose value is blank and who has nothing inside the open tag and close tag. And that's how you just create a blank option in one of these drop-down menus. And then I have this, and this is where it gets interesting. What's really nice about PHP is that it doesn't just have for loops and while loops and do while loops. It has some other useful mechanisms that some of you might have seen in Java or other languages, namely for each. For each is just a for loop. It doesn't do anything fundamentally new, but it allows you to write some code a little more simply and a little more quickly. And I can say something like this, for each array as variable. So what do I mean by that? Its first keyword inside its pair of parentheses is to put the name of an array, the variable for an array, in which case dorms. Then you literally write as, and then you choose any variable name you want, $i, $n, $dorm in this case, just to be conceptually consistent. And what's really neat about this construct is on every iteration of this for each loop, it's going to assign to this value the first element in dorms, then on the next iteration, the second element in dorms, then on the next iteration, the third, and so forth. So you don't have to do this very annoying bracket $i notation that we've been doing for weeks. You can just conceptually loop over all the elements in array and assign each of them to $dorm one at a time. Now I need to dynamically output this option element. So notice what I'm doing here. Option value equals quote, unquote. But notice again, I'm commingling PHP and HTML here. So I need to quickly drop into PHP mode, output the value of some variable, then drop out of PHP mode. And so that's what I'm doing. Open bracket, question mark, equal sign, which says put the value of the following variable here. What variable? Dorm. quote unquote. And then also, because the option element, not unlike hyperreferences, has both a value that you actually that actually gets stored, like a URL, and what you see, I'm also just going to put verbatim the dorm's name out here as well. And so the end result, if we go to this example here, FroshIM6, is really the same form, but now we're starting to leverage some of our program. Oh, damn it. Now we're starting to leverage some of our programming skills. I'm going to cheat and tell you that this is it, because I already fixed this one. And now we have this dropdown whose first element is blank, but then whose subsequent elements actually have all of these dorms. And so here, too, is where things start to get even more and more powerful. Just to contextualize this, something like, I mean, frankly, even something like Harvard FML, which is actually outsourced to, I think, Tumblr, which is a third-party blogging software, they use some kind of database. And in that database are, row by row, all of the posts that people have made. If that site happens to be implemented in PHP, doesn't have to be, but maybe it is, you can imagine getting back an array of all of the posts on Harvard FML and then just using some fairly succinct syntax, like for each posts as post. And then this is how you see the exact same structure for every one of the posts on something like Harvard FML, but the content changes. But it's really just being generated by a for loop. So much like we used for loops in C to generate any kind of cyclical structures, similarly might we do this here in PHP as well. So let me go ahead and spoil just a couple of more details and show us the most fun one, which is going to be this one. All right. So in froshims8.php, we finally have, all right, there we go. This one's clean. In froshims8.php, notice that it actually submits to a file called register8.php. And I don't actually have eight versions of registration. I just wanted the numbers to line up, if you're following along on paper. So this form looks exactly the same as every other, but it submits to register8.php. Because I got tired being the proctor of dealing with all of these emails, so now I actually want to store this information in a database. So I'll look back at the code in a moment, but let's go ahead and introduce the actual database in which we'll store this. So a database is really just a database, as most people know it, is what's called a relational database. And a relational database is essentially some kind of special server software that stores lots of tables. And a table is just something with rows and columns. It's just a spreadsheet, for those if that's the most familiar notion. So there exist various implementations of this idea of a database. There exists Microsoft Access, Microsoft SQL Server, Oracle, and then something called MySQL, and dozens of others. But MySQL is one of the most popular free open source database servers. And by open source, that means you can look at the source code that other people have written, and it powers such sites as Facebook. Frankly, it was Facebook was really one of its biggest proponents in recent years at really pushing it to its limits in terms of scalability, and they still use it for much of their data. So what better option is there when it's free, and apparently it scales pretty darn well. So we too, because of its relative ease of use and its free availability, use MySQL for this portion of the course, which is to say that we, the course, run a database server. And what's neat is you can go on your own laptop and download the same software and run a database on your laptop. Odds are that's not useful for other people, because your laptop's probably not a web server on the internet. So generally, when you have a database server, it lives on some central server, like the cloud. If you decide to commercialize or just migrate your final projects, though, off to a commercial web host at the end of the semester, almost every commercial web host out there these days provides MySQL servers. So it's very easy to run your data elsewhere. So what does this actually mean? Well, I need some way of actually creating these things called tables in the course's database server. And for this, something like this, FroshIM, feels like I just need one table, one spreadsheet, each of whose columns are going to be name, and then a captain column, and a gender column, and a dorm column, and that's about it. So if you were to pull up Google Docs or Google Spreadsheets or Excel, you would just write those labels at the top of the field. But because we're actually using this in a programming context, I'm actually going to pull up this tool. So there is a program that lives per problem set 7 at cloud.cs50.net/phpmyadmin. It's actually a coincidence that the thing is called phpmyadmin. It does happen to be written in PHP, but we're using it because it's a wonderfully user-friendly web-based GUI for interacting with a database server. So when you pull up this URL, you're prompted to log in with a username and password. PSET 7 will tell you exactly what that username and password are, and you'll see this interface. And frankly, this is a little overwhelming at first, but almost everything on the right-hand side we can ignore. more from now on, because the only thing I care about at the moment is the fact that now that I've logged in, I have access to a database that we've created for you all, and mine happens to be called malin_lecture. Yours will be called username_pset7. So I'm going to click this, and now notice, no tables found in database. So this is what would happen to in a commercial web host, or if you installed this software on your own laptop, you would initially have no actual tables in your database. So you can think of table really as a worksheet, like a spreadsheet has multiple worksheets in Excel and Google Docs. So I have no tables yet, so I need one. So I'm going to create one called registrants, let's say, for all the people who have registered. And then how many fields? Quick sanity check. 4. So then I'm going to click go. And realize there are different ways of interacting with a database server. This is just one free, user-friendly way of doing it. So now you'll see on the page that appears, it's kind of wide on my screen here, but I'm being asked for a few answers to questions. First, I'm being asked to answer, what do you want to call this field? So I'm going to quickly say name field. This one's going to be, let's see, what was it, captain. This next one is going to be gender, and this last one is going to be dorm. But there's a few other questions I need to answer. Unlike PHP, which doesn't really have explicit data types, at least that you need to mention, it's a little more like C, MySQL, because when you're using a database, it's actually really useful to know what type of data you're storing for performance reasons. Now, for our example here, there's never going to be more than like 1,600 freshmen registered. But again, consider Facebook, consider Google Docs, consider any context where there's actually thousands of entries or millions of entries. In fact, we've been running some of those CS50 apps now that you might have played with this semester for 2 or 3 years. And some of those databases, case in point, if we go to tweets.cs50.net, we have a MySQL table that stores all the tweets. And right now, it has 105,654 tweets that people have tweeted just in a row in a database. And that's not even considered that big. So you can actually do some neat things with the software. But we need to choose a type. Now, for a name, we want a string, conceptually. But in MySQL, there's different types of strings, but we'll highlight just one for now. Varchar is perhaps the most common. Varchar is variable char. And this is when you know you want a string of characters, but you're not quite sure how long that string is going to be. But MySQL does demand that you give it an upper bound. So very common for a name might be, how many characters do we need to allow for a person's name? I mean, like, 10 feels too short, 20 feels like it's short. I mean, frankly, there's not that much harm in just rounding up, frankly. So let's say 255, it's a pretty good upper bound, even for certain foreign names, which might be longer than traditional American names. Like, that gives us a pretty good buffer. But we could go even higher, 1,024. You know, generally, people have rules of thumb that they stick to. 255 is a popular convention, because years ago, this actually used to be the maximum, though now it's 65,000 characters. That's probably overkill for someone's name. Now, what about captain? So how do you implement the notion of a captain? What data type instinctively might you want? So a Boolean. So it turns out that MySQL and generally SQL databases might not support Booleans per se, but they can mimic them. In fact, even if we see it here, let me scroll back up, there is a Boolean value there. But you can actually implement a Boolean, frankly, with just an int or a short or 8 or char, frankly. So that's actually what the database server is doing. It's calling it a Boolean. But to be honest, this is probably going to cost us at least 8 bits. It's just computers deal usually with bytes, not individual bits. So that's fine. Now captain's going to be a Boolean. Gender, meanwhile, I actually have a few options here. So I could do something like another Boolean, and I could rename gender to be female. And then it can just be true or false, or it could be male and be false or true. I could do something like an int and just assume that 0 is female, 1 is male. I could do a string and actually store M or F. I could store male or female. Frankly, there's so many different ways. Let's go ahead here and let's just leave it as, let's say, let's just do 255 again, because we won't think about it too hard here, but it's going to be a string. We'll store male or female or something like that. But it might not be the best decision, but it'll get the job done for now. And then dorm, this probably should be a varchar, and we'll say 255. But again, we're not using 255 bytes necessarily. It will use a variable number. This is just an upper bound. Now, finally, if I scroll over here, you're asked a few more questions, which eventually become relevant. Do you want this thing to have a default value? For instance, do you want it to be null? Do you want everybody's default name to be John Harvard? You could do that at the database level by typing it into this field. But for now, I'm just going to go ahead and click save. And now notice, I'm returned to this tab here. This is the so-called structure tab. And now you just see a little reminder of all of the fields you just created, their default types. And then only because MySQL was originally written by some Swedes, the default collation refers to Swedish. It's not a problem. You can fit all the American characters inside of the same encoding scheme. So it's not a bug. It's a feature. They wrote it. They get to decide the default encoding. So what's now the takeaway? Well, let me go back to FroshIM's 8 and register 8. Notice now I have the following code. And I'll just tease you with some of it first, and then we'll look at more detail. Turns out there's a function called MySQL Connect that's using my very public username and password now. I then have a function called MySQL Select Database, because there's going to be hundreds of databases on this server. I want to select just mine, called Malin Lecture. Then there's going to be some code down here where I'm going to scrub the user's input. Turns out there's a lot of bad things people can do by knowing this language we're about to look at called SQL, whereby they can log into your website, they can delete your data if they know what they're doing. But the real magic boils down to this. Instead of sending an email, I'm ultimately going to call a function called MySQL Query, whose purpose in life is to take a query, which we'll write in a moment, store that data not in an email, but into that database. So now, if I've done all this correctly, I can visit froshims8.php. I can say David Malin, and we'll be a captain, gender, and we'll say Matthews, and click register. And it says you are registered, really. That means nothing. So now let me go back to my database, which the proctor could do, or frankly, I'd probably make a more user-friendly interface for the proctor. I, being the programmer, don't mind so much. I'm going to click browse, and wow, I now have stored in my table, my spreadsheet, now this record, which means now I can do anything I want with this data. I can email it out later. I can render it on a website. I can search it, sort it. More on that in after a five-minute break. All right, so we are back. That was enough time for me to fix my bug. I forgot how to compute percents, and I also forgot how to sort. So both bugs have been fixed, much to my disappointment, though thankfully Ben, Joseph, and Brooke have pulled behind me in the leadings. I am now back at 0%, ranked number 15 here, since my penny stocks have probably gone back up. But Michael and Zach are doing pretty well. They are now up 200 and 100% respectively. So good luck. Inevitably, this turns out to be not so much who's really good at investing at Harvard, but who's really good about leveraging certain weaknesses in the big board, namely that one comes to mind, not to spoil. We'll spoil this. We'll give you guys the edge. And for those not here, they won't know this trick. So it turns out that if stock quotes are not real time, and there are on something like Yahoo Finance, but other stock quotes are real time on like Bloomberg TV or CNN or your own E-Trade account, turns out that you can effectively see into the future by about 15 minutes. So if you are, in fact, watching certain penny stocks and realize, wow, that stock just shot up on my real E-Trade account, you still have about 15 minutes to scoop up as many shares as you can on the CS50 Finance version of it. Also, too, with a lot of these penny stocks, actually, I don't mind just divulging this, because inevitably every semester there's some student who thinks he or she's really being clever and gaming the system, when really we're just not telling you about these weaknesses. So now, full disclosure, let's see if we can really push the maximum amount of money earned in 3 weeks' time up. The other weakness, of course, is if you're buying like 10,000 shares or 100,000 shares of some penny stock in our simulator here, probably in the real world, you yourself are going to drive the price way up. And so you're not going to actually get that penny stock for a penny. So realize that you got to take some of this with a grain of salt. But what's neat is you can actually see what each other are doing if you'd like to learn just how good they are, just how clever they're being. For instance, Michael has really been an active day trader here in the one day this is available, playing with what are actually not some terribly cheap stock, so perhaps he has some ability to see into the future. I just went with one penny stock at 41 cents there, and I'm going to hang on to it. I'm a long-term investor with these penny stocks. So in any case, how do we actually now start storing this data, just like the data you're seeing there on the big board, into an actual database? Well, it turns out the magic there derives from a language called SQL, Structured Query Language. This is not so much a programming language as it is, as the Q denotes, a query language, whereby if you have a database and you want to grab data from that database, you need some way of expressing it. And it turns out you can do most database manipulations with just four basic commands. One is insert, and we actually use that already, and we'll pull back that layer in a moment of my code. Select if you want to grab data from the database, update if you just want to tweak something, and delete if you want to delete from the database. And there are a bunch of other statements that you can execute in SQL, but these are probably by far the most common and certainly the most useful to learn from the get-go. So let's go ahead and take a look here. So if I go back into this very last FroshIAMS example, you will see in FroshIAMS, in register 8, that I did the following. At the very top of the file, first I have my sanity check. If name is blank or gender is blank or dorm is blank, redirect the user to this location, which is that long URL, just because I put a lot of subdirectories there. But in other words, get them out of here. Like send them back to the form and let them resubmit. This isn't the most user-friendly form. There's no feedback here. So realize each of these examples should be looked at in isolation. Sometimes we have red text saying there's an error. Sometimes we don't bother. Each of these examples is meant to illustrate, per the comments atop each, a different point. But let's suppose that we pass the validation. In other words, the user has not left any of those fields blank, so we don't execute this branch, and so we reach this line of code. It turns out that if you want to connect to a MySQL database in PHP code, it's very simple. And realize that MySQL is not at all tied to PHP. You can connect to it in Java, in C, in C++, in C#, really any of your favorite languages you can use to connect to this type of database. And so that's nice. We're really not tying our hands with one language here. So how do you connect to a database? Well, I read the manual and found that there's a function called MySQL Connect, and it takes three arguments. One, the IP address or the domain name of the server to which you want to connect. As you'll see in the problem set and in your distribution code, mysql.localdomain is the made-up domain name that we created for our database server. And I say made up because we don't want this database server out there on the internet for other people to connect to and interact with. We want it just to be private to us on the cloud. So we came up with this local domain moniker instead of using .com or .edu. It's only accessible within the cloud. Now it takes my username as my second argument, my password as my third argument. And then I now have a connection to that database, assuming everything was correct. And so now I have to select a specific database because, again, there's like 500 databases on this server. I want to choose specifically my own, which in this case is called Malin Lecture. Yours, again, will be called jharvard_pset7 or something like that. Now notice this. And I've commented the code to make clear what's going on. There's not many lines of code required to get data into a database. Pretty much the same number as was required to make an email. So scrub inputs. So this is actually a good habit to get into very early on. There is what's known in the world, something called a SQL injection attack. This essentially is an attack whereby a sufficiently clever adversary goes to your web page, which has some kind of HTML form, and instead of typing in David to the form, instead of typing in expected text into that form, instead this adversary starts tossing in weird characters, like maybe some quotes, maybe some semicolons, maybe the keyword delete. The whole idea being they're trying to insert dangerous commands into your database without your realizing it so that you might be tricked into executing this code. We'll talk more about this in due time, perhaps. But for now, know that any time you insert data into a database that was handed to you by a user, you should call this idiotically named function, MySQL_real_escape_string. So 0 points for style there, frankly. But that's what we're stuck with. That function's purpose in life is essentially to put backslashes in front of any of those scary characters like semicolons and quotes that just in general have caused us a little bit of concern because they're used for programming syntax. So for now, realize what I'm doing. I'm declaring a variable called $name. I am storing in it ultimately whatever the user typed in, the value of name, and that's super global, but I'm first escaping it with MySQL real escape string. Now notice what I'm doing next. It turns out post for captain, recall what's submitted for captain. We saw this last week. If you check that box, the value of on, O-N is submitted, and if you don't check that box, nothing is submitted. So my little trick here is to just treat that kind of as a Boolean value. If the captain field in the super global evaluates to true, and it will if there's anything there. So remember, there's a lot of implicit casting that's possible in programming, whereby anything non-zero is essentially true. So I'm leveraging that understanding, and I'm saying if the captain field is anything other than false, anything other than blank, then I'm going to assume that the user checked that box, and I'm going to set a local variable called captain equal to 1. Else, I'm going to set captain equal to 0. Now, here's a curiosity about PHP 2. and it kind of gets a bad rap for being a little too loose with some of these details, you do not need to declare variables in PHP. Notice I am just on the fly, whenever the heck I want, declaring variables. $name, $captain. In fact, in the context of C, this would be a big no-no, right? This is essentially, this variable is scoped here. And you can use curly braces in PHP, but like C, if you only have one line of code, it doesn't matter. In C, I think even on quiz zero, this got us into trouble because these variables were scoped too tightly. In PHP, once you declare a variable, you're stuck with it. It now exists everywhere in that file, even inside of curly braces and outside of them. So on the one hand, this is kind of useful because it can let you, the programmer, be a little more lax when it comes to the structuring of your code, but it can also very quickly lead to bad habits. So realize here, feels okay to be doing what I'm doing because I'm always initializing captain to 1 or 0, but even I have cut corners in the past where, recall from a previous example, I set that variable called $error, and I set it to true, but nowhere in my code did I ever explicitly set it to false. I just assumed that if I don't set it to true, it would be false. But again, this is really just a different programming paradigm. In a language like PHP, people do tend to take these liberties, whereas something like C is much more anal about how you have to write your code. So it's a good thing and a bad thing, so long as you start to not abuse some of these features by just declaring things all over the place. But here, I proceed to declare gender. I'm storing the value of the escaped version of gender in that variable, and same with dorm. So in short, with those several lines of code, I just wanted four new variables, name, captain, gender, dorm, that stored the same thing that the user typed in, but the escaped versions of them, just so I don't accidentally delete my data by being tricked into registering delete Malin and not David Malin. So now I prepare the query. There's different ways to do this, but notice what I've done here. Ultimately, I need to execute a query like this. Insert into the name of the table, then in parentheses, I specify a comma-separated list of the fields that I want to insert values into. What's nice is with a database table, you can have 20 fields, and you don't have to fill all of them out. It might be reasonable for some fields to be blank. Maybe someone doesn't have a website, and so the URL of their homepage should be blank. Maybe they don't want to give you their email address, so maybe you don't want to fill in that field. So by parenthesizing this list of field names, you can say, I only want to insert a row into my table for these specific fields. In this case, it's of course all four of them, but it doesn't have to be. Now, what values do you want to put in there? Well, notice here, this wrapped onto two lines, and that's okay. I just move the second line down below, and that's fine in PHP. Notice I have now values, parenthesis, close parenthesis, and then another comma-separated list. But you have to bear in mind, and this is one of the most common sort of gotchas in office hours and in these P sets, you realize that any time you have a string in PHP, you must quote it. Now, you can use double quotes, you can use single quotes, so long as you're consistent. I use single quotes here, but notice I put single quotes around name, around gender, and around dorm, but not around captain, because captain I decided would be an integer, so it doesn't need to have them there. So at the end of the day, the string that I've just stored in a variable called SQL looks a little something like this. Insert into registrants the name, captain, gender, dorm, values, quote unquote, David Malin, captain, I think I said, I think I sent an M, and then dorm was Matthews. So this is the string that I've just constructed dynamically by way of using these variables and this placeholder, these variables inside of this bigger string. So the magic then happens with this one line of code. I've now constructed what's called a SQL statement, a SQL query. That's the insert statement. I then pass it to the function called MySQL query, whose purpose in life, because I've already connected to the database, I've already selected my database, all that happened before, is now to execute that query against the database. And so the reason that this row ended up in my table a moment ago was because that insert statement just got executed. In fact, I can simulate this myself. Rather than go through the web, let me actually show you that this thing is in fact doing what I say. I'm going to go to phpMyAdmin, just this little tool. We've seen the structure tab. That just reminds me what this thing looks like. We've seen the browse tab. That shows me what's inside there. I can actually interact with SQL directly. If I click the SQL tab, notice I just get a big text area that I can type any commands into that I want. And here too, this is why it's a wonderfully useful learning tool, because you can just play. And it doesn't really matter, especially when you have no data to lose, if you get something wrong. So I'm going to try pasting this in. And instead of registering myself, I'll register Jansu this time. We'll change this to female, this to Elliot. And then let me go back here and click go. And now it says up top, one row inserted. So let's see if that's true. Click browse, zoom out, and sure enough, now I have two rows in this table. Now suppose I want to get all those users back. I'll come to the question in just one moment. Now I want them all back. I'm going to actually go to another piece of code I wrote here called registrants.php. And now I've dynamically generated a web page that executed instantaneously that does not have David or Jansu hard-coded into it, but it's apparently outputting a bulleted list by way of a select query, which we'll see in just a second. Yeah?
So what you did when you dynamically compared
those very strings, was that analogous to doing like sprintf? Very similar, yes. So in C, you can use sprintf. That actually exists in PHP as well. There's many, many ways to construct a string on the fly in PHP. And just plugging in these variables, as I've done here, is legitimate in PHP. And frankly, it's arguably a little simpler than having to use those %s placeholders everywhere. So let me draw our attention then to this. So this might be, for instance, the PHP page that I give to the proctor when it comes time for him or her to see who's registered for some sport. At the top of this page, registrants.php, notice that I connect to the database again with my username, with my password. I select the same database, and then I create this query. Select star, where star means everything, give me all of the rows, from registrants. Now I execute this query, but this time, because I'm asking for data, I have to remember the return value. I can't just call MySQL query and then call it a day. I need to get back the server's answer, so I store in a variable I called result. Now let's fast forward. I seem to be exiting PHP mode, outputting a default web page, but then notice this. What's really neat, I have this UL tag, which stands for unordered list, and if you look at this up in the manual, a UL tag has to have LI, list item tags, inside of it, and every one of those list item tags becomes a bullet. And so what I'm doing here is outputting one or more bullets. So how am I iterating over the results? And here is where the really neat feature is of this, this being able to program against the database. I can call a function called MySQL fetch array. Where do I want to fetch an array from? I specify $result as the argument. And that says, fetch them from the results I just got from the database. On every iteration of this loop, store that array in a variable called $row, because conceptually, when I say select star, that means give me all of the rows. So when I iterate over each of these, I'm being handed that row really nicely as an associative array. So just as these columns have names, name, and dorm, and gender, and captain, I can now get those values just as though they were from an HTML form. This time they're coming from a database by way of their names. And so this time I'm going to print a list item tag, then I'm going to close it. But inside of that, I'm going to print out $row, quote unquote, name. And what that's going to do is output David Malin, then Jansu Aidada, and then that's it for that loop. And as an aside, too, to get us in the habit of best practices, HTML special chars is a function that also takes care of any dangerous characters so that if a malicious user actually typed in something like open bracket, blink, close bracket, they couldn't trick me into outputting a web page for this proctor where all of the names are actually blinking by having entered, again, a blink tag and not an actual name. So we're really just scratching the surface of all of these features. On Wednesday, we'll introduce a language called JavaScript, and with it, a technology called Ajax, with which all of today's modern sites are now leveraging. We'll see you then.